From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
How are you defining the word Lúthromán to a new audience?
Lúthromán, yes. From James Joyce. He was the one who actually first brought this to our, to the world's attention, I suppose.
If it was any bit of danger, that you might think that, look, this dog is going to go for me, I just bring me a bottle of water with me and spray it at the dog's face.
8 out of 10 who now work from home agree or strongly agree that their work-life balance has improved.
Coming up on this random Wednesday edition of Playback Daily, Irish words hoovered up by the English Dictionary Industrial Complex. Man wets dog, the hazards faced by postal delivery workers. And working from home for the win. How COVID has changed our lives 5 years later. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's more to about eating that spice bag without a mineral. And first up today, as part of his morning monologue, Oliver Callan was sounding a gloomy note, which is fair when you hear what forces have brought him to this frame of mind.
The Ides of March would have been 11 days ago, but it is the 25th and 26th. It's this week, basically. The auguries and foreboding and doom seem to be everywhere you look. Here in Ireland, the Dáil Éireann in utter chaos. Count Corlea Verona Murphy is on the brink. The opposition, men and women of every party, howled and roared rudely for a full 6 minutes of parliamentary speaking time yesterday. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin was tittering and sniggering away, and his excuses get lamer by the minute. And then the vote was just horsed through. And to celebrate, Michael Lowry stuck up his two fingers at Paul Murphy, who is one of several TDs recording the scenes in breach of the rules. We'll break that down in a minute. But across in America, you have the fallout from one of the highest ranking officials in the US government adding a journalist to a group chat and accidentally texting him classified war plans to bomb Yemen in advance of that actually happening. Over the water in Britain, not to be left out, the Chancellor of the Exchequer this morning is preparing a series of kind of austerity-like measures, basically. There's going to be a tidal wave of cuts to benefits on the poor and £36 worth of tax rises in a single week on homes and businesses, a record. So good times to be around, for sure.
For sure. That was the executive summary, then followed the detailed report, starting at home.
Leinster House, for those of you who have really been paying attention ever, grown-ups are there elected to write laws to make life better for citizens, people who pay taxes and who get along their business, fix things like the housing disaster, the health shambles, the immigration system in bits. So for 2 months, with a break for sipping pints around the world to say how great the government as Parliament is, nothing has been done at all. Elaine Loughlin, the political editor of The Examiner, points out today just one single piece of legislation has been passed since the general election last November. That law was the one to allow a record number of junior ministers. And the front pages this morning highlight all of the chaos. The Daily Mail and The Star going for a holy show. That's the headline there. The Independent went for chaos, farce and disgrace. And in every single newspaper, you have the photograph of Michael Lowry, a former Fine Gael minister, condemned by the tribunal, re-elected every single time in Tipperary, with his two fingers pointing out at us. Literally everywhere, The Examiner, The Irish Times even put it on its front page. It's gone viral online, that clip that was shot by Paul Murphy. It was on the TV news yesterday. And Deputy Lowry's statement is that the video of him laughing, flipping his two fingers at Paul Murphy while shouting, "Woo!" was in fact a gesture to get the Dáil deputy to sit down. Now, everybody was streaming out of the Dáil at that stage. So that is that's what they do in Tipperary. So what you do to get someone to sit down, stick your two fingers up, flip them a couple of times, go, "Yo!" laugh and have a bit of crack. It is the image of this whole thing now. He won't mind a bit. He doesn't really mind. The Irish Sun headline is, "How low can you go?" with the low as in Lowry next to that image on the front page. Let's have a look and see what Miriam Lord is saying, because she usually distills these things very well on days like today. Two-digit TD for tip gives smug masterclass. That's the headline. And she says, more than once, Count Corlea Verona Murphy glared at the howling opposition and bellowed the line destined to go around the world the moment she uttered it.
Yourselves.
An absolute holy show. By the way, the government backbenchers kind of applauded that as well. And Miriam Lord says they were too, to be sure, but not as much as Michael Lowry or indeed young Barry Heenahan from Dublin Bay North, who began aping the more unsavoury moves of his regional independent group leader Lowry by laughing and waving dismissively at incandescent members of the opposition. Actually, side note here is that the video of Lowry flipping the two fingers, like Father Dick Byrne and Father Ted, as many newspapers point out this morning. Barry Heenan is standing up next to him, hands in the pockets, the gut out, like a country lad at a wedding around 11 o'clock, you know, sweating from the dance floor. It's quite the image for Irish politics right now. Back to Miriam Lord. And then the Taoiseach going to the wire for two Gidget Lowry, the beckoning bounder of Irish politics. Sometimes Micheál was angry. Most times he chuckled at the massed ranks of the indignant and full cry across the floor. "You're all in high dough," laughed Micheál, looking up to the press gallery to see how that went down. Lowry loved it. He fell around the place. And then there's more commentary from Ivana Matchicken. Lowry and young Barry fell around the place again. Fianna Fáil's John McGuinness, the last Ciarán Comhairle. He was the man expected to get Verona Murphy's job. And occasional critic of his own party, Miriam says, he looked down grimly from his seat at the back row of the coalition benches. In the same row, Sean O'Farrell, former two-term Ciarán Comhairle, put his head in his hands as the decibel level went through the roof. That's kind of important because Sean O'Farrell would have been seen as shafted to allow Verona Murphy to become the Ciarán Comhairle at the behest of Michael Lowry. And Miriam says, Cian O'Callaghan of the Social Democrats made a telling point to the Taoiseach. A few government TDs winced when he made it. Your backbenchers are well aware you wouldn't be going to these extremes for them.
There was more on our politicians' holy show, but I think nearly 4 minutes will do us. And things get even better from here on in, right? Oh, actually, no. It's over to the even more shambolic government of Europe's former allies.
The media having great fun pounding away at the Trump administration over that stunning story where war plans were live-linked to a journalist on the commercial Signal messaging app. It's rather like WhatsApp. One of them, in fact, received the messages on this highly hackable social media app while in Moscow. They're in Moscow while getting the messages. Talk about serving it on a platter to Putin. Fox News, their slant on it is the massively embarrassing leak about... It's a bombing, by the way, that did kill people. They said this shows transparency, leaking this to the journalists. Trump supporters, though, are blaming the journalist himself, Jeffrey Goldberg, who was added through no fault of his own and, in fact, didn't really believe it. And the chat shows are indulging in this heavily. Here's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. He's been highlighting how, you know, the journalists quite understandably thought this was an amusing hoax until the very dark thing happened.
You know, back in my day, if you were a journalist who wanted leaked war documents, you had to work the sources, meet them in a dark garage, earn the trust, pound the pavement. Now, you just wait for the National Security Advisor to be distracted by White Lotus while he's setting up his bomb Yemen group chat. By the way, I might be in this group chat. I don't know. I don't check my group chats. Perhaps my favorite text of the entire group chain was the one from our defense secretary saying, quote, "We are currently clean on OPSEC." For those of you who don't know, OPSEC means operational security. He said that in a group chat. A group chat with a journalist. The journalist said that he didn't think that the story was real until Yemen was bombed.
Oof. There you go. But and the oomph from the audience there is the fact that 15 people were killed in the airstrikes. The US say they were terrorists. And last night, then Ronnie Cheng, also on The Daily Show, summed up how this story is really a cautionary tale for every one of us who's ever been in a WhatsApp group or chain chat of any kind. And I think The Daily Show is kind of the sharpest at the minute doing this satire at a time, let's face it, of war.
Well, laugh it up, people, because unlike you, I have human empathy for these people who are just trying their best to kill other humans, all right? And I guarantee that if anyone in this audience had their group chats leaked, it would ruin every single one of your lives. I personally have chats that are actually more sensitive than a missile attack on the Houthis, okay? If you told me that my group chats leaked and then told me it was just my missile attack one, I'd be like, oh my God, thank God, thank God. And by the way, it wasn't even Pete Hegseth who added him. It was some other incompetent guy at the highest levels of government, okay? Like, what, you think Hegseth has the editor of the Atlantic magazine saved in his phone? No way, all right? If Hegseth autofilled a contact into a group chat, it would be like Tampa Bay blonde with Bugs Bunny tattoo. But still, you gotta ask, how did this happen? I mean, don't you guys have tech support in the government? I mean, what? Oh.
That's a picture of Elon Musk that they're laughing at there. Yeah, who's literally called himself tech support for all the good that is done.
Yeah, so much dumb in one place. Let's finish up our monologue excerpt with a nice little story about Stephen Adolescence Graham.
the Netflix Adolescence show, which has obviously shocked parents of teenagers who haven't been paying attention for the last 10 or 15 years of what's going on social media. But extraordinarily, so many people have watched this show now on Netflix that in Britain, which sometimes I think include figures in Ireland as well, we don't know, they don't break it down in Netflix. Netflix drama has become the first programme on a streaming platform to become the number one most watched show on TV audiences in Britain. So 6.5 million people watched the first episode in a week. The second one, 6 million viewers. And the third place show was The Apprentice, which is on terrestrial, linear television, whatever you want to call it, broadcast television, as opposed to streamers. Streamers, that's the first time ever that's happened. I think that's a remarkable thing. Stephen Graham, who's the star of that, by the way, with his Liverpool accent, is also in the news because he, in his next thing, is playing Bruce Springsteen's father in a biopic which stars Jeremy Allen White as Springsteen in the recording the Nebraska album. That's 1982, when there's tension between the boss and his dad. And Stephen Graham revealed that he got a text from Bruce Springsteen, who has seen the film and said it was beautiful, and said that getting a text was the was basically the best ever. It would be better than any award, is what he says, basically.
A nice text from the boss. What more could you want? That's the little upbeat ending to our coverage of the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan, right there. Statistics tell us, Claire Byrne says, that 1 in 4 households in Ireland have a dog. This tends to make life more difficult than it needs to be for postal delivery workers. This morning, reporter Brian O'Connell told us how he'd joined Christy Condon on his postal route near Blarney in County Cork to see for himself just how much of an issue poor dog behaviour is.
He has several decades working delivering post and parcels. He has been attacked a number of times by dogs during his career. We'll learn a little bit how he's dealt with them. But since COVID, I suppose more and more homes have dogs, some of them perhaps not being controlled as well as before. And when I joined Christy on the route early yesterday morning, he just wanted to show me, Claire, how much of a relationship he builds up with dogs along the way and how some of them he has to earn their trust, as you can imagine. And then one or two of them, I suppose he never fully trusts them and he keeps his distance, although that's not always possible.
I know the area, I know a lot of the people, and obviously you get to know the dogs as well. If you're calling to the dog every couple of days, you want to be on his side, you want to be friends with it, you know.
Are certain dogs along this route, I'd imagine, who aren't as welcoming?
Maybe so. The first stop here now, there's two dogs with possibly two different personalities. One is quite vocal and the other's very, very quiet.
Are you a dog man?
Oh yeah, 3 dogs at home.
And I'd imagine, Christy, post-COVID, it seems like every second house has a dog now. Have you noticed that increase?
Yes, yeah. And also, when COVID did hit, all the families were at home, all the kids were at home, and they found that a couple of dogs, they get more aggressive, protecting the family.
So we're just pulling into a property here now. There's a nice, looks like a collie dog.
He might come up, I see, almost
he's just,
around
he's
me.
Just come up to us,
you
here,
know.
Yeah.
Very friendly, but you'll be afraid in case he could trip you up.
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah. So there'll be 2 dogs here now as well. One is quite friendly, but the other one, he doesn't say much, but would approach.
Property we just went past there. There was a dog who looked a little more fearful.
Yes, he was inside in an area, but there was a radio fence, so he can't come out to you because if he does, he'd get a shock.
Tell me about the bottle of water.
If it was any bit of danger, like you might think that, look, this dog is going to go for me. I just bring my bottle of water with me and spray it at the dog's face.
I can see by the look of the dog already, he's sort of slightly hunched forward. He's got that look.
He doesn't want to be friends.
Yeah.
No.
How many times over the years, Christy, have you had a negative experience with dogs? Or you've been bitten, have you?
I've been bitten approximately, just like I said, 3 or 4 times. In the last year, I had 3 near misses, and with the 3 times, the owners were also present with their dog.
So the dog went for you or
yes.
Got aggressive, and the owner was present. So is this where owners are not seeing that in their own dogs?
I think it's almost a denial that they don't think that their dog, which they love and the dog loves them, would ever do anything out of the way to anybody.
And in those cases, you managed to get out of the situation?
I was lucky. One went for my back of my leg, one went for my thigh, and the third one was sort of chewing on my ring gear.
Gosh, three near misses in the past year. Now, Brian, you got to meet some of those dogs and their owners along the route too.
Well, you could hear in the clip some dogs we stayed well back from. They gave a clear indication that Christy was probably just about tolerated, but they were a little bit uncomfortable with him being on the property. Many of the dogs were walking around freely. I mean, this is a mainly rural route we were on. Now, some dogs also made sure that Christy did stop and did interact with them. Probably, Claire, something to do with the bag of dog treats he kept in the back of the van, as we'll hear in this compilation. So we've just pulled up to the gates here and we can hear quite a lot of barking.
Yeah, an older dog, you know, could be near the end for this fella. Never had an issue with him, but he might come out and say hello to us just to tell us who he is, and this is his property. Just getting what I'm getting for the lads is a bony home, half and a bony each.
So you have a little dog biscuit for them. And you can see both their tails are wagging.
You're a good dog. And chat.
So that's bribery, basically.
Christy. Yeah.
My man brings her a treat. She talks to him.
I suppose you'd be conscious as a dog owner, though, would you, of someone coming onto the property?
Oh, absolutely. And the bottom line is a dog is a dog. Yes. Molly.
Hello, Molly. Well, I can see Molly straight away is submissive. You know, she's down. She's rolling on her back here. Hello, Molly. Course,
we had a dog once and she was possessed with following the wheels, the tyres and the van. Don't ask me why. And the only other person she used to be allergic to come in was the priest. When she'd see the priest, she'd go crazy. The postman and the priest.
This guy is a beauty. He's a fierce-looking dog. When I met this guy first, I went, whoa. But...
Well, I could just say, looking at this dog, it's quite an intimidating-looking breed, right?
I have no issue at all with him.
He's mad to get on radio. So you're giving him a treat?
We'll give him a treat. We'll give him a big one today. He deserves it.
Beautiful dog. But the tail is wagging, even though he is, you know, he's checking us out, but the tail is wagging.
Yeah. He's a course.
So that's a dog that you would have got to know.
I would, yeah. As I said, when I met the dog first, I was afraid of my life of him, to be honest with you. But he'd often approach it with a big rock in his mouth. What he wants you to do, he'd drop in front of you, just throw the rock and he'd run after it and get it for you, you know?
So this is your last stop on this route.
Yeah.
We have a collie, looks like. Tail is wagging away there.
Lovely dog, yeah. The owner is inside. She might come out to us, but this dog now will want the belly rub.
The minute you got out of the van,
she
wants her belly rub. Good girl. Beautiful dog. It's not the first time you've rubbed their belly, I'd say, Christy.
No.
Like if Carlsberg did dogs, really.
Oh, this would be the ultimate dog, really, I suppose, you know, to be fair. Very, very affectionate. Wants a belly rub every morning. So, yeah, lovely, lovely girl.
So some great examples there of how he's handling the dogs and getting on great with some of them. But the issue in general of dogs attacking postal delivery workers, Brian, it's significant, isn't it?
It is. And then that issue of COVID, I mean, I suppose some dogs perhaps weren't socialised during COVID. So we have a significant number of first time owners, new dog owners. And there is this tendency, I mean, I'm guilty of it ourselves, of humanising dogs, which is understandable. They become such a part of your family. But they are an animal, as that woman said. And as such, owners obviously have responsibility. Now, I spoke to Conor Collin, who's the on-post health and safety advisor for Munster. I began by asking him if the issues around dogs have always been there and if he could quantify where it is now.
It's always been there. Ask any postal operative and they'll tell you at some stage they've been menaced, threatened, bitten. It's increasing. We bear in mind that the population has increased. Number of dog owners has increased. Online shopping has increased. And our stats will tell us that the number of incidents have gone up.
Give us a sense of how many incidents you might be dealing with.
2024 was 150 reported incidents. In terms of lost days, we're looking... 2024 was 840 lost days through injuries caused by animal attacks.
And obviously we saw this morning a lot of the interactions were quite positive, quite benign, but we don't want to sugarcoat it. I've been in cases here where people have been very seriously injured.
Absolutely, and only recently a colleague in the Munster area, attacked by two dogs, ended up in hospital. Thankfully he's doing very, very well and is recovering. He'll receive every support that Unpus can give him, but it was avoidable. And his injuries were quite severe. He will have scars for a very long time.
You have a scar yourself?
I have a small scar from a little Jack Russell, delivering on the bike many, many years ago in Douglas. We've all had the interactions.
So what's the message you want to get out there?
the message, which thankfully has also been sent out by the government as of yesterday, is to remind dog owners, to remind them of their responsibility. It's not the postal operative's fault. It's not the dog's fault. Ultimately, the dog owner, the animal owner, is fully responsible. And we ask that when our delivery staff are arriving, that they're aware of that and they take precautions to make sure that the animals are secured.
That's Conor Colin on Post's health and safety advisor for Munster, ending Brian O'Connell's report on postal delivery workers and dogs from this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. On this afternoon's Live Line, Teresa talked to Katie Hannan about the ridiculous scenes in the Dáil as the row over speaking time rumbles on. Teresa, like many of us, wondered what the politicians are playing at when the country has so many issues that need to be addressed. She was, in short, not impressed.
Disgraceful. Utterly disgraceful. These are people that's meant to be representing us. And the carry-ons of them is disgusting. They were like children in a playground.
I don't know with that many children in the playground get away with what Michael Lowry is pictured all over the place today doing. Well, what he's saying, it was an errant gesture under provocation and that it was taken out of context. I think the rest of us would call it giving the two fingers. Teresa, just tell me a bit about yourself, because you do a very important job there.
Yeah, well, I'm a carer with Wicklow Community Service here in Wicklow Town. And all of us carers do a really good job, as far as I'm concerned. And, like, for the work that we do, the wages that we get is ridiculous. And at the end of the day, for a carer to go into elderly people's homes to assist them with living at home for as long as they possibly can, we're the eyes and the ears of the nurses, of the OTs, of all of them. If we see anything going wrong, we're the ones that will inform our line manager, and they in return will contact whoever's needed to be contacted. And for our payments that we get is absolutely ridiculous. And it's not just that, Katie. It's like, you go into homes, you see it in some homes, not all homes, some homes, and you see it in friends' homes and relatives of friends, and that the elderly are struggling. The elderly are really struggling. And I feel there is no one, but no one up in the government really cares all that much, because if they cared that much, they would have got their act together long before yesterday, long before last week. You take, for instance, an old man or an old woman that can no longer live at home. Their siblings can't contend with them, let it be through Alzheimer's, through whatever illness it is. They have to, when they get sick, then they're in a hospital. They are waiting on a bed in a nursing home. Now, this person is waiting in a nursing in a hospital for, it could be a month, it could be 2 months, until a bed becomes vacant, or until Fair Deal has passed through that, yeah, there's adequate funding there for the bed in the nursing home. Like,
and we know the trouble, yeah. People. We know the problems that for the situation, to leave somebody in that situation is desperate anyway, but we know the problem that's causing to the system as well.
Exactly. And like, these are the people that paved the pathways for us, made our lives what they are today. They try to make a better life for us than what they had. And now at the end of the day, they're shoved in the corner. Shut up. Shut your mouth there. You've served your purpose. That's the way that I feel that the government treats them.
And Teresa, I know that you've had a tough time yourselves in your house there, because you needed carers for your own husband there.
I sure did, yeah, bless them. Yeah, I had two wonderful carers, let me stress, two wonderful carers that came in.
Tell us what happened to Billy.
Billy developed dementia 15 years ago. Now he's 67 this year. So we got it very young.
Oh, he was only, what, 52?
Yeah. So we kept him at home. He was pretty good. He'd stayed at a level for so long and, you know, kept him at home for as long as I could. Then we had the two carers coming in and they were brilliant. Billy bonded with them great. They had a great personality, just like Billy. And but then it got to an extreme where even the carers, even though I had noticed it, but kind of refused to accept it, because I just didn't want to part with the person I loved so dearly. And they had brought it to my attention, saying, look, Teresa, Billy is pretty bad. You know, he's crying all the time. He's afraid. He doesn't know what he's afraid of. And there's no getting around him. And so it ended up that I brought him into Lockhamstown Hospital. Mm-hmm. Now, he did have a slight infection. But they had to keep him there for about a month until we found a nursing home that could take him. And lucky enough, my manager, Andrea, she called me into the office one day. She was so kind and sweet about it. I'll never forget it. She called me into the office and she went through all the nursing homes. She made the phone calls for me and we got him a beautiful nursing home down in Arklow, the Ashland House.
And he's comfortable and happy there now, Teresa.
He loves it now. It was so hard at first. Oh my God, it was horrible. Yeah. The hardest thing I ever had to do. But then I used to take him home on the weekends and that was great. But now he's got to a stage where he can't. I can take him home, but he has to go back there to sleep. He's got too bad for that side of it. But he loves it. He calls it home. Whenever I take him out each day, whenever I take him out, he'd say, Teresa, when am I going home? That's to his nursing home.
Yeah. And God, and he's only 67 still. He's such a young
67.
Man.
Yeah. But it's lovely. I'll have to say, Katie, I'll have to say about that nursing home, it's lovely. They haven't spoiled rotten. The staff is wonderful. Jan is great with him and Vichy. He absolutely adores Vichy. So Vichy is the nurse. So I'm happy because he's happy. Now I leave there and my heart will be down around my kneecaps. But he's happy.
That's Teresa talking to Katie Hannon on this afternoon's Liveline about her husband. Teresa, who's a carer herself, is not at all impressed with the row rumbling on in the Dáil while the country waits for the government to get its act together. All living languages evolve and change, and some of that change involves borrowing words from other languages. English is no exception to this, of course, but where it borrows its words from might come as a surprise. This morning, Oliver Callan spoke to Fiona McPherson, senior editor at the Oxford English Dictionary, about words from Ireland that have been included in the latest update to the dictionary. One of those words, well, two of those words really, is spice bag.
It was a brand new one on me. I'd never heard of it before. So the idea of a takeaway meal, I don't really need to tell you what it is, do I? And the interesting thing I think here is it's that whole sort of mix of different sort of influences, if you like, with the type of, you know, the spices and everything. But also our first example of it is actually from a tweet that somebody did in 2012, who were actually going to go round to the place where apparently it originated, which is called the Sunflower in Dublin, to go and get one. So that's a really nice first example that we were able to find of someone actually about to go and take one. But yeah, brand new. I'd never heard of it before, before I saw it in this update. So a kind of nice one to start off with,
I think. And to find it's chips, shredded deep fried chicken, fried onions, red green peppers, chili peppers, jalapenos and various spices all topped together. Very good. The word class has a new meaning.
Mm. class, yeah. Now, this is an interesting one because it's also actually used in parts of England as well as being used in Irish English.
Interesting.
Class as a sort of general term of approval, you know, yeah. Great, fantastic. And one of our quotations that we've included is from Derry Girls, which I think is a nice way of illustrating that sometimes, I mean, it goes back longer than that, so it's older than that. It's 1980s, I think, we can first find it.
Yeah.
But sometimes it takes popular culture to bring something more to the fore, if you
I
like,
see.
Especially yeah. in parts of the country maybe where it's not used so often. But we've got an example from Yorkshire in there as well, so I think they're used to talking about things being class. But chiefly Irish English and
that
this
class,
yeah, English
particularly
usage.
Ulster. And here is how it's used in Derry Girls.
This one's called Boys. I think boys are really class, especially the ones who have a nice ass. It's called haiku. That's not what I would call it.
An unforgettable haiku.
That's
usage of class. How are you defining the word Ludramon to a new audience?
Ludramon, yes. From James Joyce. He was the one who actually first brought this to our, to the world's attention, I suppose. Ludramon we have as a lazy, unproductive or stupid person, especially a man. It can be a bit derogatory, as you know, you probably would get from that. And interestingly, that's got so many different types of spellings as well. We've got something like 12 different ways to spell that. James Joyce himself had quite a few more letters in there than what you might expect to see now, which is Ludramon.
And are you not using the little accent, which we call a fodder over here? That's
yes, not in our head word, and that's a bit of dictionary jargon there for you. That the head word is the word that you look up that everything comes under.
Oh, right.
No, we haven't. I mean, in that normally what we would do is we use the most common form that we can find in modern English, and we would use that to help inform which one we would use. Yeah.
Okay, and blah, people in County Waterford in the south of Ireland will be delighted. To hear BLAA yes. is finally in the Oxford English Dictionary.
A soft white bread roll. And that's interesting because there's often a lot of, well, maybe not controversy, but certainly debate all over the world, really, about what name you give to this particular foodstuff. So, yeah, we've added blah. I mean, you also have it, as you sort of imply, called a Waterford blah. So a soft white bread roll, dusted with flour, and it's particularly associated, I think, with that part of Ireland. But, yeah, that's now in there too.
And I think the Debs is in there as well.
How
do you decide what words get in? What's the criteria that finally a word has landed and has to be known to the English world?
It's all about evidence. So you kind of hit upon it there. Can we find enough examples of people using it and in a sort of general way? And that would also, one thing we have to think about as well, and this is especially true of, you know, say words from Irish English, is it being used by the people you would expect to be using it? So some of these words, they're not going to necessarily use them in all parts of the world or, you know, in parts of Britain or wherever. But are we seeing them in use in Irish English by the people we would expect to see them? And that's really the bottom line. We don't include anything that we can't find that evidence for. And then once we sort of see that basic benchmark established, that's when we go on and research, trying to find the first example that we can and take it from there.
Great. You've had a very interesting job. Editor at the Oxford English Dictionary.
Not bad.
Is the HQ still in Oxford?
It is, yes. It is. But with the internet, you know,
you can work from everywhere.
Anything is possible. You can work from everywhere, yeah.
And you are full time, so every day. What's a daily job like?
Every day, yeah. You will have what we call a suggestion lands on your desk, and it's all about finding if there's that benchmark of evidence, as I said, and then if you find that there is that, then it's about researching it, finding the earliest example, looking at the quotations that you can find to try and get a handle on what it means, because, you know, not every word is going to necessarily be familiar to you.
Yeah.
Trying to work out what the etymology might be, where the word came from, and just making sure that you're sort of able to explain what it means in a sort of meaningful way for people. But that is the day job. Just another, every day brings a new word to try and look to and research for future inclusion.
We might say it's a class job you have.
You might, yes, exactly.
You must have huge qualifications because you sound very learned.
Well, yeah, keep saying that. I studied English language at university.
That
so I'm lucky in that I'm actually, you know, that's actually something that I can draw upon and use if I can remember that far back in my job. So it's nice to be able to put it to good use.
I love that you sound so excited about words. So we let you get back to that job because you're like an investigator. Yep. You're like a word detective.
Oh, right. That's
but
it.
Senior
that's
editor.
That's my new byline.
Senior editor and newly crowned word detective at the Oxford English Dictionary, Fiona McPherson, talking about additions to the dictionary from Ireland. Would love to hear someone like the previously mentioned Stephen Graham saying Ludramon. Maybe in Adolescence Season 2? Now is the time, according to Claire Byrne, when we should be checking our passports. Are they in date? Does little Callum need his own passport now? To answer the passport-related questions of listeners and to advise on the pitfalls to watch out for, Claire was joined this morning by Una Fannin, Director of the Passport Service.
So for anyone who's planning a holiday this year, the message is just check your passport. If you have a new baby or a child who's never had a passport before, make sure you apply online and in plenty of time before your travel date.
So what's the peak time then for people getting in touch ahead of the summer, concerned about whether their passport's in date or not, or whether they can travel on it?
So we find that even though people are do apply quite early in the year for their passports, our busiest times are between January and April. However, our phone lines are particularly busy in the month of May, June, July. And that's when, you know, people are getting anxious about whether their passport's going to arrive on time. I will say we are within our turnaround times for applications. And so it is important that you don't put that stress on yourself by leaving it maybe up to the date of when you're travelling to get that passport.
Sure,
so definitely apply in plenty of time.
I'm sure a question that you and your colleagues get asked all the time is, you know, I'm travelling in the next 2 weeks. I've got 6 weeks left before my passport expires. Will I be stopped with this document? What's the answer to that?
So it depends on where you're travelling to, really. Many countries outside of the EU in particular do require a six-month validity on the passport. So if you've any doubt about it, I would say do go ahead and renew that passport.
OK, and you can do that, can you, 6 months before the passport is due to expire?
Oh, absolutely. We'll take it within a year of its expiry date and renew it. And I suppose an important service that we have also is if you're travelling imminently and you do realise that you need to renew your passport, we do have an urgent appointment system in Dublin and in Cork for people who need to get a passport urgently. Mm-hmm. And that's both for children and adults, but only for renewals. We can't do a first-time application
okay.
over the counter.
So if people really are stuck, they can go to the passport office and have it done there?
Yes, so if you go on, you can book an urgent appointment with us on our website, ireland.ie, and you can book either a same-day turnaround time or a four-day turnaround time, depending on when your travel is. There is an additional fee for that, but it just gives that peace of mind that you will have the passport in time.
The one-day turnaround, is that available in the Dublin Passport Office only?
Yes, so the Dublin Passport Office offers a same-day turnaround and a four-day, and then our Cork office offers a four-day turnaround.
All right. Una, it's probably worth going through the current waiting times then when you apply for a passport, because they are different, aren't they, for the different categories?
Absolutely. So an adult online renewal is 10 working days. The child online renewal is 15 working days. And then a first-time application, whether it's a child or an adult, is 20 working days. And that's all through the online passport online channel. Then our paper service is 8 weeks turnaround time for both first-time applications and renewals. Mm-hmm. So certainly the online channel is the quickest and most efficient way to apply for the passport.
But you really do have to give yourself enough time on that, because you might say to yourself, well, I'll have it back in 10 days. But then as it goes through the process, there is a possibility that a problem could be identified with your application. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. So if there is an issue possibly with your photo, maybe the background of the photo is, you know, isn't going through our system, or there's maybe an issue around a witness witnessing the consent form or the guardian consent form for a child, we will need to reach out to you and ask you to send those documents back in again. Now, we do have a 10-day turnaround time once the documents come back in. But I would say, again, in order to to preempt any issues that there may be with your application, that you should apply in plenty of time.
Mm-hmm. Because when you submit your photograph online, you can get the green tick, it's gone through, but then it has to be reviewed by a human. Isn't that right? And you might run into problems.
Exactly. There are a certain number of specifications that will go through automatically our system, but then every photo is looked at by one of our staff here. And so if there are additional issues with the photo, it may be rejected. However, I would say we have a very good video guide to submitting photos, passport photos, on our website. So ireland.ie photo guidelines, and we have a great step-by-step video there for how to take a photo that will pass through our systems.
Now, Una, you've kindly agreed to take questions and I have plenty for you, so let's get through some of them now. So this listener is originally from Canada but moved to Ireland several years ago. I've obtained Irish citizenship, however I haven't applied for an Irish passport. I believe I may need to submit my Canadian passport as part of the application process. Is that required?
So we will take a certified copy of a Canadian passport as part of the ID documents that need to be submitted.
So you would need to supply that. And they wonder how long it would take to have that Canadian passport returned. They're hesitant to proceed with the application because they're uneasy about sending the passport in without knowing when they'll get it back.
Well, all of our supporting documents are returned within 10 days of the issuance of the passport. So we do return them quite quickly once your passport is issued. But as I said, the original passport would not be required.
Okay. Oh, it wouldn't be required. You don't need to send in the Canadian passport.
No, it's a certified copy of the
passport. Okay. So the original doesn't need to go in. Well, that might provide some comfort there. Now, this next listener wants to change their name on the passport and they just wonder how long that will take.
So that would be a complex renewal and that is a 15-day turnaround time. And I would say on a name change, if it's through marriage, we will change it with the on production of the marriage certificate. But if it's a name change for another reason, we do require 2 years proof of usage of that new name before we can issue a passport in the new name.
Now, this listener has a valid 10-year US visa on their passport, but the passport is soon out of date, Una. So the question is, how can they transfer the valid visa onto the new passport?
So I would say they do need to renew their Irish passport because if they're travelling to the US, they will need a valid Irish passport to do so. I would think in terms of the visa, I suppose that would be more of a question for the US embassy. I think they should contact them to ask that question.
Or maybe think about their life choices if they're planning to travel to the US in the first place. That's Una Fannin, Director of the Passport Service, talking sense on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. The CSO has published its findings on the social impact of the COVID pandemic 5 years on. And this afternoon, Ray Darcy was joined by statistician Claire Burke to talk about the changes that have stayed with us since March 2020.
A lot of habits were formed during the pandemic.
They were. For instance, hand washing. Actually, it's quite interesting. During the pandemic, the Department of Health did some research and they found out that 96% of people washed their hands more often than before the pandemic at that time. And that 90% of people said they would continue to wash their hands more frequently. However, as part of our survey, we asked respondents how they compare their hand washing now compared to before the pandemic. And actually, only more than half say that it has increased. So it just shows the intention was there. But
still, that's more than 50%.
It is, yeah.
It has changed their behaviour.
Yes, yeah. And it's actually more, it's younger respondents that are most likely to report they wash their hands more often than older.
And did any of them mention Joe Duffy in their replies? Because it's funny though, whenever I say to the, at home, wash your hands, immediately Joe's voice comes into my head, wash your hands. And is there a difference between men and women when it comes to washing hands?
There are. Women are considerably more likely to say they wash their hands more often now compared with men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were asked to stay in. We had a 2 kilometres radius, then a 5 kilometre radius. And there was a lot less social interaction.
Yes. Yeah.
And I suppose a big fear at the time was going into any place that had a crowd.
Yes.
Has that lingered?
Well, we did ask respondents how they currently interact with people outside of the home now compared with how they did before the onset of the pandemic. So we asked about avoidance of handshaking, social gatherings, avoiding meeting other people when they themselves are sick or other people are sick, and social distancing. And we found that women are considerably more likely to attempt to avoid handshaking compared to males. Slightly higher proportions say they try to avoid social gatherings. And they are more likely to try and avoid others when they themselves are sick and when others are sick. And then we also found that those with poorer health are more likely to change how they interact with people outside of their home. They're four times more likely to report that they avoid social interactions compared with those with very good health. And they're twice as likely to try and social distance than those with better health.
Right. I suppose we became hyper aware of how diseases work and how they spread. We learnt an awful lot about it, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah, and as a result, probably that has changed our behaviour.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And this is an interesting one on religious ceremonies.
Yes. We asked respondents, did they regularly attend religious ceremonies in person before COVID-19 restrictions were first introduced? So of our respondents, and I have to say people were invited to participate, so it may not be nationally representative.
Okay.
So 20% of our respondents said that they attended religious ceremonies in person prior to the pandemic. And of those that did regularly attend in person in March 2020, just more than half still regularly attend in person. 8% or 1 in 12 say they attend online, while only less than 4 say they no longer frequent on a regular basis. So it's the older respondents are actually most likely to still attend religious ceremonies, yeah, either in person or online. And conversely, it's younger respondents. 2/3 of younger respondents say they no longer attend in any form.
So it's fallen off in a big way.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. We'll never know why that happened in particular. You know, what's going on in people's heads. You don't ask them that. But it is. So if only 20% said they were attending religious ceremonies
of
beforehand.
Of our respondents, yes.
Yes,
yeah.
And then 50% said they don't do it anymore. So that's down to 10%.
Yeah.
So it's a very small proportion of people. So our interpersonal relationships.
Yes. So we asked respondents who they lived with during the pandemic, and then we asked them how they thought the pandemic impacted on their current relationships. So on the whole, surprisingly, respondents were more likely to report that the pandemic has had a positive impact on their relationships than a negative impact. And this includes their relationships with their partner, their spouse, their children, siblings, parents. So both women and men responded similarly, which is good. So it's not a one-sided perception.
But there's a sort of caveat there in that people who are less well off.
Yes, yes. Households that were financially less well off were more likely to report negative impacts on their relationship than those that were better off. We found. Yeah. So
that sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
It does.
If you had the wherewithal to get the takeaways in and do all the things that, you know, that would make the experience more comfortable.
Yes, yes.
It's more likely that there wouldn't be tensions on your relationship, whereas
exactly.
if you didn't have that money, then there would be tensions on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And we found that employees that started working remotely from home since the onset of the pandemic, they're actually more likely to say that the pandemic had a positive impact on their relationship with their partners and the spouse and their children compared with those that went out to work, that didn't have the opportunity to work from home.
Is that the biggest change that was forced on us by the pandemic, working from home?
I suppose it depends on if, well, I'd say for a lot of people,
yes,
that was
the
biggest change, wasn't it? And
yes.
it impacted all aspects of their lives, from childcare and their social interactions and their friendships. And
what did you find on working from home?
Of employees who didn't usually work from home prior to March 2020, we asked them about their current working arrangements, whether they were working remotely from home now or not. And then for those that are new to working from home, we asked them on their work-life balance, their job satisfaction and their relationships with their work colleagues.
Okay.
So how working from home is impacting those. So on the whole, most people, 8 out of 10 who now work from home, agree or strongly agree that their work-life balance has improved. There's a notable difference between those under 50s and over 50s. Those under 50s are more likely to say that their work-life balance has improved rather than those over 50.
Okay.
Same with job satisfaction. Most agree or strongly agree that their job satisfaction has improved, but it's the younger respondents rather than the older respondents that are feeling this way. And 1 in 8 of those in their 50s say that disagreed or strongly disagreed that their job satisfaction has improved. And then on the whole, twice more likely respondents or employees working from home were more likely to say that working from home had a positive impact on their relationships with their work colleagues than negative. So on the whole, from a
positive thing.
It is positive. Positive, yes.
Definitely from a worker's point of view.
Yes, yeah.
Some employers, not so much, I suspect. That's Claire Burke, statistician with the CSO, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about the lasting social impact of the COVID pandemic 5 years later. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Kevin Penrose is a young Gaelic footballer from County Tyrone who's been, in Oliver Callan's words, out and about talking about his personal life. Kevin joined Oliver in studio this morning.
What is the personal news you have been sharing with the GAA world?
So recently, well, I've been out now as gay maybe the past 3 years, coming up 3 years, and only recently I done a podcast maybe about a month ago now and sort of shared it with the world. It was already shared with the world, I guess, but within like the GAA sphere, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
I was on the GAA social podcast and sort of had a new demographic, I guess, you know, and it's something that hasn't really been addressed before, really known.
Oh, it's a rarity. It's extraordinary. Yeah. It's a rarity. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You must be feeling good about it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Weight off my shoulders.
It is a big weight off your shoulders, even though you have come out to friends and family 3 years ago, you said?
Yeah, coming up 3 years ago. Yeah.
This is like another coming out again to the GAA family and community.
Basically.
Which is extraordinarily rare. You have to go back to Donal O'Cusack in 2009 when he came out. We thought, oh, the floodgates will be open now. Yeah. Everyone can live their lives openly. And that is 16 years ago. And there's still no inter-county players who are out. You're a club player.
Mm-hmm.
But it's extraordinary and well done.
Thank you.
And you should feel good about it, by the way. The reaction's been good.
Yeah, it's been absolutely positive. Like, there's been no negativity whatsoever, you know. Through social media as well, like the messages I'm getting of people who are in similar positions that I was in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to know that they can sort of resonate with that, you know, and see someone who has done it, I guess, and come out the other side and the positivity that's come along with it. Hopefully they can find some comfort in that.
What are you telling them?
Basically, just share my story. You know, I can't really tell them wrong or right. You know, it's just sort of what I went through. And a lot of the times it's sort of the same thing where you don't really feel comfortable. You either get away from your hometown, you don't play football, you just leave it all together. And you often see like a lot of people travel to abroad or to Dublin or Belfast or wherever, especially from the rural communities. And like it takes them a long time to come out then, but they don't often go back to playing football after it, you know?
Yeah.
Which is quite a shame because it could be talented footballers, you know, at the end of the day, you know?
It's nearly your story. Sure, let's get into it. Athy Aran, tell us where Athy Aran sits in the nobility of Tyrone football, because the clubs of Moy and Trillick more recently as well, and all those big names.
Yes.
Errigal, St. Kieran's. Where does Athy Aran sit among them?
So we are Division 2. We're in the back end of nowhere, basically. We're in the border of Donegal, you know, so it's a place that a lot of teams don't like to travel to, you know.
There aren't even many towns there. Would Ballybuffet be the closest town?
Ballybuffet, yeah. And then with Castledarrig, our neighbouring county, you know, of course, you know, and then maybe like 30 minutes from Oma as well, you know, so it's...
And do you come from a big GAA family?
Oh, yeah, big GAA family. Like, we've all been playing since we've been young ones, you know, four brothers, four boys in the family. So it's been really engraved on us, you know, from a young age.
Where do you sit among the four boys?
I'm the third born.
You're the third born?
Yeah.
Middle child.
Middle child.
That comes with its own.
That's it, you know. Yeah.
And you have all Ireland medals in the family.
I do. Not myself, unfortunately.
No.
But my
not older, yet, anyway.
Not yet. Well, my older brother, Martin, he was a county player back in the day, played for a very long time from minor the whole way up to senior. And he's got a few All-Irelands in the back pocket.
Martin Penrose. Is he still playing in the club?
Well, he's debating it as a question for him if he's going to play this year or not. He's playing last year. He's 41 now, so he's still playing. He's still fit for it. And he's still a great footballer, you know. But it's at that time now where he's settled and he has four boys of his own. And it's sort of going by their schedule, you know.
Yeah.
So there's, so you never know.
Them boys, they can go forever in the club, particularly if you have two All-Ireland medals in your back pocket.
That's it.
You can carry on. What age are you?
I'm 31, so I am.
31, and Big J family. I presume your dad, was he a player in his day as
well? Oh, yeah. Big player as well, sort of thing, you know.
Everyone is involved.
Everyone's involved. In the house. And dad as well, he was coaching the whole way through as well, you know, so...
No choice to get into football. Were you good as a young fella?
I like to think so, you know.
Yeah?
You know?
Well, you've made teams in Joel along the way.
Oh, yeah. Teams along the way. And we've won a few underage stuff, you know. And then it was sort of the teenage years when I sort of dwindled out of it and then out for, I'd say, the guts of 7, 8, 9, 10 years, I guess, you know, until...
You were out of it?
Out of it. Well, in the night, you know.
It became harder for you. At what age did it become hard to be a player and be comfortable?
I would say around 17, 18, I started to feel... I was different in a sense, you know, but I couldn't really put my finger on it back then, you know, but looking back, your sort of teenage years or your hard years of discovering yourself in a way, never mind being gay in a rural GAA community. So only looking back now, it's like, oh, I was starting to feel it there, but it wasn't until I was like 23, 24, where I was like, okay, maybe I am actually gay, you know?
Yeah.
But at that stage, I went to university in Liverpool, so I was already trying to get out. In a sense, I guess, you know.
The subconscious was struggling to get out. So you left, you went to college. What did you do in Liverpool?
I'd done sports development and PE. So
Sports.
But the thoughts going to Liverpool, okay, I'll be getting away from GAA, from the Irish people, but you know yourself, Liverpool is just basically, everyone you know is there, you know. So
I wonder actually how Irish is Liverpool when you go there as a student. Is it?
Oh, it's full Irish. Just
was it?
Like a, it's a,
from everywhere?
Another county, I guess, you know, in Ireland, you know.
From everywhere in Ireland?
From everywhere, yeah. You know,
really?
And it was one of my things where it's like, I got roped into the GAA team over there again, you know, so I couldn't even explore my sexuality over there fully, I guess, you know, just because it's sort of...
You stayed in the closet?
Stayed in the closet.
Were you still figuring out your sexuality? Is that...
Yeah, I guess so.
Student.
But it's one of the things where you're like, okay, you're sort of living the double life. You have like... the university experience, but then you're playing football, but you're playing football with lads who are from the neighbouring counties or neighbouring clubs back home.
Right. So, you're
so it's one of them things,
them.
You're hiding from them sort of thing. So I was like, okay, I'm going to university now. Here's my chance to explore this a bit more. And then you're sort of going back into yourself just in a different country, unfortunately, just in case.
Did you even have a double life? Were you able to be yourself
100%.
In college? Yeah.
So there was myself, but then like, again, like I live with all English people just to sort of change who's hanging out with, I guess, you know.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
And then of course then just a double life then of going to football in the evening time, but it's just one of them things you can't really.
Does that mean you could date and you could have relationships with your college friends and then you became old Kevin?
To an extent, I guess, you know, like not even a lot of people knew. I think maybe one or two people at the time over in England knew, but it wasn't until maybe 4 years now where I started telling people properly in Ireland, I guess, you know. It was just the fear of, okay, college is over, I have to go back to Ireland now, so I can't really be fully myself again, you know. So it's sort of one step forward, two steps back.
I have to go back to Ireland now, so I can't really be fully myself. Isn't that something in these interesting times of ours? That's Tyrone footballer Kevin Penrose talking about coming out with Oliver Callan this morning. And that's all I have for you on this last Wednesday in March edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has a better, stronger, faster look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.